Today is Friday, May 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinero Fo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russian forces make gains in eastern Donbass, but Kyiv says it will not give up territory to appease Moscow.
Ukrainian authorities said on Thursday that Russian forces were coming closer to surrounding Ukrainian troops, adding that they briefly seized positions on the last highway.
A top U.S. diplomat says China poses the most serious long-term challenge to the international order.
Addressing the Asia Society, Secretary of State Antony Blinken termed China a bigger threat to the Western-led order than Russia.
And Turkey plans to return 1 million Syrian refugees amid growing public animosity. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Advancing Russian forces have come closer to surrounding Ukrainian troops in the eastern Donbass region, gaining grounds as they press forward with their assault. But Kyiv says it is not prepared to give up any territory to appease Moscow. Louisa Nax of Reuters reports.
Ukrainian authorities said on Thursday that Russian forces were coming closer to surrounding Ukrainian troops, adding that they briefly seized positions on the last highway out of a crucial pair of Ukrainian-held cities before being beaten back. Among Moscow's victories is the town of Svitlodarsk, which fell to Russian forces earlier in the week. The streets are largely empty, and a Russian flag hangs on a local administration building. Drone footage filmed by Reuters journalists of the nearby abandoned battlefield showed scores of craters pockmarking a green field surrounded by wrecked buildings. After failing to seize the capital Kyiv in its three-month war, Russia is now trading to wrest full control of the eastern Donbass region, where it has backed a separatist revolt since 2014. It has poured thousands of troops into the region, attacking from three sides in an attempt to encircle Ukrainian forces, holding out in the city of Severodonetsk and its twin Lysychansk. Their fall would leave almost the whole of Luhansk province under Russian control. More than 40 towns in the region have been hit by Russian shelling, Ukrainian authorities said on Thursday. Among them, Kramatorsk. Lyudmila says her apartment was damaged in a strike earlier this week.
It is not nice because it caused a lot of grief. None of the rooms are left with the windows intact. No room has any windows.
Moscow denies targeting civilians in what it calls a special operation in Ukraine. In a bid to solidify its grip on the territory it has seized, President Vladimir Putin signed a decree simplifying the process for residents of newly captured districts to acquire Russian citizenship and passports. In a late-night address, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky hit out at suggestions that Kyiv give up territory and make concessions to end the war with Russia, drawing parallels with attempts to appease Nazi Germany in 1938.
And behind all these geopolitical reasons, those who advise Ukraine to give something to Russia, these great geopoliticians, don't always want to see ordinary people, ordinary Ukrainians, millions of those who actually live in the territory they propose to give in exchange for the illusion of peace.
The Kremlin said on Thursday that Moscow expected Kyiv to meet its demands, which include Ukraine acknowledging Crimea as Russian territory and recognition of breakaway Russian-backed parts of eastern Ukraine as independent states. Kyiv rejects those demands.
That's Louisa Nax of Reuters. A World Health Organization assembly on Thursday voted to adopt a Western-led resolution condemning Russia's action in Ukraine, which it says led to a health emergency. The resolution was approved by 88 votes in favor and 12 against, with 53 abstentions. Representative of the United States to the European Office of the United Nations, Bathsheba Crocker, called on member states to vote against Russia's resolution in favor of Ukraine's proposal. Moscow calls its action since February 24th a, quote, special military operation to disarm Ukraine and relative of what it calls anti-Russian nationalism fomented by the West. Ukraine and the West say Russia launched an unprovoked war of aggression. U.S. Representative to the EU Office of the UN, Bathsheba Crocker.
What is the impact of this war, if not a health crisis, one that is diverting resources and focus from others in urgent need? What is the health assembly for, if not to come together in support of all those impacted by health crises and take action when needed? WHO absolutely is the body that should take up health crises. Russia is asking you to look away from the gruesome reality, to pretend it isn't there. Their cynicism knows no bounds. They've handed you a draft resolution of their own to consider and now wish to be taken as champions of health and humanitarian relief. Incredibly, Russia has taken their text almost entirely from their failed Security Council resolution. The rest they've taken verbatim from Ukraine's resolution. The one thing they haven't taken is responsibility for the health emergency they alone are causing. This isn't about politicization. This is about the health of millions and the need to hold Russia clearly accountable. This is the time and the place for this action, time to vote yes on Ukraine's resolution. Conversely, if you vote in support of Russia's resolution, you are standing with a country trying quite literally to destroy what this body stands for.
That's representative of the United States to the European Office of the United Nations, Bathsheba Crocker. Russia is pressing the West to lift sanctions over the war in Ukraine, seeking to shift the blame for a growing food crisis, according to a Kremlin readout of a call between President Vladimir Putin and Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi. The Russian leader said Moscow is, quote, ready to make a significant contribution to overcoming the food crisis through the export of grains and fertilizer on the condition that politically motivated restrictions imposed by the West are lifted, unquote. In a major policy speech on Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said China poses the most serious long-term challenge to the international order. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
Addressing the Asia Society, Secretary of State Antony Blinken termed China a bigger threat to the Western-led order than Russia.
China's the only country with both the intent to reshape the international order and increasingly the economic, diplomatic, military, and technological power to do it.
Blinken added Washington does not desire conflict with Beijing or a new Cold War, with the United States committed to intense diplomacy alongside intense competition. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
The world watches closely when mass shootings like the one in Uvalde, Texas, claim innocent lives in the United States. Less visible is the rising rate of day-to-day gun deaths of children 14 and younger. Researchers say firearms are the number one cause of death for U.S. children. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has more.
My grandson took two shots. He got shot in his chest up close and personal, and he got shot in his head, executional style.
Malachi Jackson, gunned down in Washington, D.C. last month, was only 15 years old. His grandmother said a suspect is in custody and a criminal investigation is ongoing.
It started with two children having a fight, you know, having some words with each other. In Washington, D.C., these kids have gun ice cream. It shouldn't be that easy for a child to get a gun.
For the sake of her safety, the grandmother asked to wear a face mask on camera. Jackson is one of 500 teenagers killed this year with firearms, according to the Gun Violence Archive, which tracks gun deaths using public records. Some of these deaths are homicides, others are accidental. Mark Bryant is the Gun Violence Archive's executive director.
The teens that are 12 and up, or 10 and up, 11 and up, that can be gang activity, that can be all sorts of stuff. Children under 10, when they die by gun, they have found their father's gun, which is not properly stowed. They play with those guns, and they don't understand that there's no reset button.
The mass shootings this month in Uvalde, Texas, and Buffalo, New York, have shocked the world. But day-to-day gun violence, one of shootings like Jackson's, is an epidemic, researchers say. Firearms deaths among young people increased nearly 30% in 2020. Gun violence kills more children per capita than car crashes, drug overdoses, and even cancer, according to researchers from the University of Michigan. Mark Zimmerman is the co-director of the university's Institute for Firearm Injury Prevention.
Sometimes it's accessibility to firearms that are not their own. And sometimes it's bullying that occurs in school. Nearly 60 all firearm deaths are actually suicides. And most of those happen in rural areas.
With the COVID-19 pandemic still around, mood disorders like anxiety and depression on the rise, and ready access to guns in many U.S. states, experts say it's easy to see what's driving the numbers. Psychologist Gregory Jantz.
Anxiety disorder is the most common diagnosis out there, particularly when there's substance use mixed in. We're finding behaviors and a self-destruction and a destruction of others at a level we have never seen.
Malachi Jackson's grandmother and his family are still grieving and want politicians to keep guns out of the hands of children.
There's dying on our streets every single day. 2 and 3 kids a day. We are in an outrage. We are sad. We are confused. We need harder laws.
The National Rifle Association, which for years pushed looser gun laws, didn't reply to our interview request. The group's annual convention starts Friday in Houston, Texas, just days after an 18-year-old with an assault rifle slaughtered 19 children and 2 teachers at Robb Elementary. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
In other news, the Palestinian Authority says its investigation into the shooting death of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh proves that she was deliberately killed by Israeli forces. Israel's defense chief called that a, quote, blatant lie, unquote. Abu Akleh, veteran Palestinian-American reporter of Al Jazeera's Arabic service, was shot in the head on May 11th during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Attorney General announced the results of his investigation at a news conference on Thursday. He says soldiers were aware journalists were in the area and that Abu Akleh was shot, quote, directly and deliberately, unquote, as she tried to escape. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Analysts say the persistent drought drying out the Horn of Africa is a reflection of severe weather intensified by climate change. For Ethiopia's pastoralists, who have been more than 1 million livestock perished, it is a sign that life cannot be sustained by the next generation. Linda Giftash reports from Gode, Ethiopia.
Carcasses of cattle scattered across fields have become an all-too-familiar sight here in Ethiopia's Somali region. Despite a last-ditch effort to feed her cattle with grass from her thatch roof, Addis Ahmed Omar says they all perished. Her family is now among the 7.2 million Ethiopians who are not getting enough to eat, according to the United Nations. She says when she was young, droughts used to occur at once, and they coped and survived with it. But this current drought is continuous and recurrent, and is beyond their capacities to manage. Drought events aren't just lasting longer, they're becoming more frequent. Some former pastoralists at a displacement camp outside the town of Gode lost their livestock in 2017. They've become permanent residents of the area, having abandoned their nomadic lifestyle to instead rear small animals like goats and grow produce. Abdiwali Mohamed Salad is the village chief. He says it's better to search for other livelihoods than pastoralism. Education and other livelihoods means farming. He says mixed farming is an option available to them in the future as a means of getting by. Climate change is projected to bring even more extreme conditions in the years to come, with contrasting droughts and floods. That will also contribute to soil erosion and degradation, shrinking the available land for pasture. Within this year, experts say there is a 61% chance the region's next rainy season will fail, devastating even more pastoralists. Abubakar Saleh Babakar is with the World Meteorological Association in Ethiopia.
It is very challenging for them to continue the same way of life, depending on just natural resources. So the future is not bright, unfortunately to say. But that's where they need to adapt to the new climate condition.
In the northern Afar region, pastoralists say they shouldn't have to abandon their tradition. Instead, they want more support from the government to protect grazing land and to develop programs to provide emergency feed and medication for livestock. Valerie Browning works with the Afar Pastoralist Development Association in Samara.
AFAR have this wealth of traditional knowledge, this wealth of what to do when it's too dry, there's no water, this wealth of how to look after their herd. But politics doesn't allow them.
At a clinic 100 kilometers from Afar's capital of Samarra, Biru Ali, a pastoralist mother, is not as optimistic. Surviving on just bread and rations of water trucked in by aid groups, she says her two-year-old is now sick with diarrhea. She says what she wishes for her children is for them to get an education, and once they grow up, they'll be able to achieve great things. While many say they would welcome an alternative future for their children, now faced with hunger, their focus is on simply surviving today. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Gode, Ethiopia.
Turkey President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is pledging to return as many as 1 million Syrians amid growing public animosity against the refugees. Their presence is a potential political liability for Erdogan, but as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, his plan for the refugees' repatriation is already drawing criticism.
An estimated 4 million Syrian refugees are in Turkey now, having fled the long-running conflict in their country. Now, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says his government will return 1 million refugees to Syria voluntarily, with promises to build 100,000 homes, which he says offers them a chance of a new life. The Syrians would return to an area under the control of the Turkish military and Syrian rebels, outside the grasp of Damascus forces. But refugee groups warn there is little security anywhere in Syria. Haya Atasi is with the Syrian Association for Citizens' Dignity, a group that advocates for refugees in Turkey.
We have arbitrary detentions, we have forced disappearances, we have unlawful killings, we have lack of security in general when there are assassinations, when people leaving their house not knowing if they could ever come back. And this is something that's repeated everywhere in Syria, regardless of who is the party that's in control.
Erdogan is under pressure to start returning the millions of refugees in Turkey, given what pollsters suggest is growing public animosity. Can Selçuk'i is with Istanbul Economics Research.
The 61% that agrees or definitely agrees with the fact that a more tougher stance should be taken towards Syrian refugees stems directly from the negative news that we are seeing that connects Syrian refugees with crime. And on the back of this economic downturn, I think the Syrian refugee or the refugee issue becomes a more heated issue where emotions tend to get out of hand.
Last year, angry mobs attacked a district in the capital, Ankara, where many Syrian refugees live. A video depicting a dystopian Turkey where Arabs run the country has gone viral. Social media is awash with anti-refugee sentiments. Ahead of next year's presidential elections, most opposition parties are calling for the return of refugees. Didem Danush, with the Association for Migration Research in Turkey, says the issue has become a top political issue ahead of presidential elections next year.
It will be certainly one of the main issues in the political campaigns for the elections. And this is one of the weakest points of the government, together with the economic crisis, of course. But the opposition parties will use it a lot.
Turkish security forces are now routinely rounding up and deporting those they claim are illegal migrants. At the same time, refugees face increasing restrictions to encourage them to return to Syria. But some analysts warn such pressure could lead to another refugee exodus to Europe. Omar Kadkur is with the Economic Policy Research Foundation of Turkey.
If they feel that they are left between a rock and a hard place, and especially knowing that they do not want to go back to Syria, moving westward might be the only option available for Syrians to live in a place where they can actually have some sort of prosperity and safety.
With millions of Syrians trapped in what is becoming a toxic political atmosphere in Turkey as elections approach, many see the lure of Europe, where their welcome is not guaranteed, as possibly their only way out. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter, On our periodic U.S. politics update, we examine the key issues dominating the political landscape. Veteran analysts John Fortier and Jim Kessler spar over the results of Democratic and Republican primaries in Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. They discuss what, if anything, Congress may do to pass gun safety legislation in response to recent mass shootings. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including President Joe Biden used the war in Ukraine to send a message to China. Biden ended his six-day trip to Asia that included a Tokyo summit with the leaders of Japan, India, and Australia. For more on this topic and others, join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
To all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinedu Afo in Washington. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the arrests by Hong Kong authorities of 90-year-old Cardinal Joseph Zen, the former Catholic Bishop of Hong Kong and outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party, and three other prominent pro-democracy advocates, Margaret Ng, a lawyer and former legislator, Hoi Po Kung, a scholar and former professor, and Denise Ho, an actress and singer. The four were trustees of the now-dissolved 612 Humanitarian Relief Fund, which was established in 2019 to provide financial and legal assistance to those who participated in pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong. They were falsely charged and arrested on May 11th for colluding with foreign forces and subsequently released on bail, but could face sentences of life imprisonment. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said, in arresting these veteran activists, scholars, and religious leaders under the so-called national security law, Hong Kong authorities have again demonstrated that they will pursue all means necessary to stifle dissent and undercut protected rights and freedoms. Then White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre called on PRC and Hong Kong authorities to cease targeting Hong Kong's advocates, noting that freedom of expression is critical to prosperous and secure societies. Over the past several years, Beijing has been increasing its control over Hong Kong, arresting democracy activists, shuttering civil society groups, and forcing independent media organizations to close. The PRC has increasingly violated the fundamental freedoms of the people of Hong Kong that were guaranteed in the Basic Law and in the Sino-British Joint Declaration when control of Hong Kong was transferred from Britain to the People's Republic of China in 1997. The arrests come just days after the only Chinese Communist Party-approved candidate for the Hong Kong chief executive position, former Hong Kong security chief John Lee Kak-chu, took office. After his so-called election, the foreign ministers of the G7 countries, which include Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, published a statement expressing grave concern over the selection process for the chief executive in Hong Kong, as part of a continued assault on political pluralism and fundamental freedoms. We continue to call on China, they declared, to act in accordance with the Sino-British Joint Declaration and its other legal obligations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.